Blog Talk Radio.
This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Whenever it is you may be listening, thank you for stopping into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show. Second show of the week, double dipping here on a Thursday. First Thursday show since the trade deadline a couple weeks ago, so less excitement than before, but I do want to circle back around to that at some point. We'll see again how much we get through here today on the radio show here over the next hour-ish. We'll see how long today's show ends up for, but should be a really, really interesting show. Of course, the way I've kind of started these things off now is being able to talk about live in-action games. And I was actually watching the Cubs and Pirates game before coming on here a little bit. And something I found funny is that the Chicago Cubs have the worst batting average of any team through a first – or sorry, let's redo that with the stat of the day. The Cubs have the second worst batting average in the history of the MLB through six games of an MLB season. And they also have an above 500 record because they've basically just been playing the Pirates and the Brewers for the first seven games of the season. And sure, you have a nice pitching staff, but playing the Pirates and Brewers makes your life so much easier because they're the Pirates and Brewers. And you can still go 4-3 while playing the entire start of your season against the Pirates and Brewers. So things are going pretty nice for the Cubs, I guess, even though they are they're up 4-2 and the game's coming to a close here today. But it's interesting because what do you do when you're in a position like Chicago? And this is something that exists in football and basketball all the time. In the NBA right now, you could go down the list of teams in this position from the Pacers on down to New Orleans and Memphis. What do you do when you are kind of stuck in the middle where you're trying to put the best product on the floor but also trying to remain within a budget? Is that your team is clearly not good enough to win the whole thing, but what do you do when you're just evaluating the roster and being like, okay, here's where we can save $2 million by cutting Kyle Schwarber and adding Joc Pederson to play leadoff and be a big power left-handed hitter? Or where we look around and we can say, let's cut Yu Darvish, but we'll add Zach Davies and kind of try and make that a mute and bring back Jake Arrieta because he's a beloved figure in that interesting situation with the Cubs. So it's just one of these situations where in the NFL you had the Falcons and the Cowboys and the Vikings and the Eagles and now the Giants. What do you do when you're actively trying to win, but you just can't put out a team that is good enough to win, but you also are too good to kind of tear it all down? You find yourself in this, like, ninth seed purgatory that the Chicago Cubs find themselves in, where they might actually be pretty good this year because they have the second worst offense by batting average in MLB history through six games, but they also are above 500, which baseball, again, sample sizes matter a lot. But I just find that really funny with how things work out for the Cubs versus the Pirates and how baseball kind of works its magic in such ways where the Chicago Cubs can be good because of the way the schedule breaks down, but we know that the Chicago Cubs aren't really that good. It's an interesting, interesting dynamic. Also, opening day for the Orioles as they play Boston in another crap matchup that we talked about last week is that everyone wants to watch John Means versus Nathan Eovaldi. Well, lo and behold, this afternoon. You can watch the magical pitching duo between Eduardo Rodriguez, who we're really happy is back, and Matt Harvey. Did I know Matt Harvey was a Baltimore Oriole until I just read that on the screen right now? No, I did not. I did not know Matt Harvey was still in baseball. But that's kind of just the entire Orioles roster at this point, isn't it? They've got Ryan Mountcastle. I'm guessing he's a young guy. Mikel Franco. Mikel Franco is funny because he went from the Phillies to Kansas City to Baltimore. And do you know how far down the list you have to fall for your last stop to be the Kansas City Royals, and then you fall further than that to Baltimore? And then you have Freddie Galvis, who's the same thing. Like, he went from Phillies to the Padres. And by the way, for 15 years, for those who may not know depth about baseball, for 15 years, the San Diego Padres were the place you went to go watch your career die. And Freddie Galvis spent a year there, goes to Cincinnati, which, as the Padres were getting better, is probably an even worse baseball hell to be in than San Diego. But then you go to the Orioles. It is a tough, tough sledding for Freddie Galvis as he tries to hang around as a starting shortstop in baseball by playing on teams that are going to lose 100 games or 90 games every single season for the last 5 years of Freddie Galvis's career. So enjoy Matt Harvey versus Eduardo Rodriguez, who I'm excited that Eduardo Rodriguez is back after fighting myocarditis as a result of his COVID-19 bout last year. So it's good to see him back and playing baseball again and pitching and being the unofficial official number one starter for the Boston Red Sox. Also, for people who got super excited about the Miami Marlins having an awesome spring training, make it 1-5 for the Miami Marlins, trying to avoid starting 1-6 against the New York Mets, who are also not off to a great start, but they got COVID stopped by the Washington Nationals, who still have not played their first game of the season. So baseball, ladies and gentlemen, is just kind of just flopping around out there. I remember last year, and we were on the radio show for this, last year was so exciting for baseball because it was the 60-game sprint, and it was our first sports in 4 months, and it felt like we were so starved for sports that it was so, so exciting. Exciting to have baseball back, and at this point we would have already been like an eighth of the way through the season because it was only a 2-month sprint, and because we'd gone 4 months without sports, it was like just pure euphoria. Now this year I feel like Jesus Christ, we're already 6 games into the baseball season and I've barely watched even like 1 to 2 baseball games up to this point. It's kind of weird how much life picks up its fast pace once everything isn't slowed down like it was in the pandemic, where we went 4 months without any live sports. And it's just kind of weird to think about it now that it was 4 months without any live sports, a full quarter of school, an extra month after that, pretty much all the way through a summer session for me. Like, it is interesting to see the changes between last year's 60-game sprint, which was the most exciting regular season I can remember to now, where the baseball season's kind of, it's like 7 games in. I'm like, oh gosh, geez, it snuck up on me real quick. It's already April. I think COVID time is also messing with that a little bit, that we've just been kind of in a COVID world for so long that's messing with me. But slowly but steadily coming out of it, that one is an undeniable fact at this point. COVID, I don't know if this is like the main story of the day, but it's just something I was kind of laughing at before coming on here. Josh Allen, the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, y'all know Josh Allen. If you don't know Josh Allen made the single greatest transformation in one season by an NFL quarterback over the last, let's say, 50 years, where season by season, Josh Allen went from having the worst completion percentage in football to the 30th completion percentage in football, to having one of the better top 7 completion percentages in football, threw 125 more yards passing, 20 more touchdowns. I think it was 20. I think it was closer to 10 more touchdowns, and improved his accuracy by 15 points. This is the greatest single-season improvement in NFL history. And Josh Allen is an anti-vaxxer. as we found out. And I made this joke, like, Josh Allen being an anti-vaxxer is like something we kind of all assumed was true, but then just hearing it out loud feels kind of strange. Because Josh Allen is the guy who is aggressively defended by people who aggressively defend particular values that are affiliated with right-leaning politics, including at the time of today with this gun control thing that's being passed, is the idea that overprotection and patriotism is kind of the people who are defending Josh Allen. And Josh Allen is in this interesting place where, because he had some controversial tweets on draft night and he fell in the draft, and because he's a white dude that comes from the country, and because Josh Allen plays in Buffalo, even though Buffalo doesn't want to hear that, because Josh Allen plays in Buffalo, Josh Allen definitely, and because he was replacing Tyrod Taylor, Josh Allen definitely has become a bit of a symbol for the great white quarterback. Not because of his political leanings, like Ryan Tannehill could be an example of the great white quarterback, but Ryan Tannehill is super progressive. So there's a specific reason why Josh Allen is reflected in the way he is. And this adds another element to it, because who do you affiliate most with anti-vaxxing? Like pre-pandemic, who do you affiliate the most with anti-vaxxers? It's dumbass white people. And sorry, it's inferring, there's not statistics there. I just find it so funny that Josh Allen is in that position, because Josh Allen is the guy who you're going to pick to, other than maybe Tom Brady. Tom Brady might be the next closest thing, but it is Josh Allen in a position where he is now going to probably get blasted a little bit over the COVID-19 stuff. And get your damn vaccine, Josh Allen. That's the other thing I have to say about that. Get your damn vaccine. It's so funny to see it happen, only because you can observe it from like a how did we get to this place kind of way. Like, Josh Allen, what is your backstory that leads you to this? And as the guy everyone kind of reflects as the great white quarterback of a new generation, like, you look at Josh Allen and you kind of think, Do you want that? And are you doing this because it's who you are? Or are you doing it for the same reason Jameis does stuff, where Jameis is just kind of dumb, and Jameis has had some serious stuff that's kind of dumb, like stealing crab legs? That's just funny to see and funny to hear, because Jameis is kind of dumb. Groping an Uber driver, not as funny. But Jameis Winston also got suspended for that. And that's the fine line that you're playing here. Josh Allen being an anti-vaxxer. Yeah, that's kind of funny. It's really kind of funny. Josh Allen's tweets from childhood emerging during the draft, not quite as funny. But it's just kind of the thing that happens when you have the dumb mantra, that Josh Allen kind of does dumb things. Not that Josh Allen is stupid, or not that Jameis Winston is stupid. They're both super smart dudes. And Jameis Winston gets the mantra because he throws a lot of interceptions. That's the other reason that people kind of conflate the two. No, he does, like, dumb stuff. Like, why you weren't really thinking when you did that kind of stuff. And Josh Allen does that, and it came back to bite him, and now that's the mantra he's getting. And the anti-vax stuff feels kind of the same way with Josh Allen. In fact, he just kind of does dumb stuff. And it's the same thing we used to make jokes about with Jameis Winston. It's good content when people do dumb stuff, because it dumbfounds us a little bit. That's kind of where the word comes from, is that it's dumbfounding when these guys do dumb stuff. And when Josh Allen says he's an anti-vaxxer, it's kind of just dumb and silly to laugh at. And this is the difficult line that you have to tread, because is COVID-19 funny? Not really. But this is the interesting line that Josh Allen is treading, because Josh Allen is probably not going to influence people's decision. That's the thing that people conflate all the time, is Josh Allen, this is a problem because other people are going to say, well, Josh Allen's not getting a vaccine, so I'm not going to get a vaccine. People were convinced by Josh Allen to not get a vaccine. They were probably not going to get it in the first place. Like, that's the part where this becomes funny. It's not a huge societal conflation thing with Josh Allen being an anti-vaxxer. Like, the people who are using Josh Allen as an example to not get a vaccine we're probably not going to get a vaccine pre-Josh Allen. I'm pretty sure that that is a very, very true statistic. I will take odds on that. That someone was like, you know, I was going to get a vaccine, but, you know, I saw Josh Allen say he was up in the air about getting a vaccine, and you know what? I'm not going to get a vaccine. Like, I dare you to find me one person in the world, maybe in Buffalo you could find one person who is crazy Josh Allen obsessed, or you can find Canadian Cutler. He's probably – that was just a silly joke. Check us out, Comical Sports Memes, for that. But just find me someone who's going to do that. I'll bet odds on that. If you can find someone who was actively planning to get a vaccine and now all of a sudden is like, well, Josh Allen said no, so I'm not going to get a vaccine. And this is why we can laugh at that, because it's just dumb. The idea that Josh Allen is an anti-vaxxer is just dumb, and it's ridiculously funny. When it's dumb and not serious, then we can laugh and crack jokes about Josh Allen wanting to be an anti-vaxxer and wanting to put his name behind that. It's just so unbelievably funny. And for Josh Allen, like, you are playing into the character that has been created by the media for you. And it dates back to when we first heard about Josh Allen, which is the fact that this dude's got a crazy cannon, but he makes poor decisions throwing the ball. And Josh Allen is the guy whose draft stock fell because of some tweets that he tweeted when he was 13, 14, 15 that are really messed up. And then he gets into the NFL and he does all the wacky diving over stuff. And he gets the narrative that he's the guy who just – Gridiron Heights does a great job of this. I love the jokes that they make. He plays into the idea where Josh Allen's just like flying down the slide head first and miraculously falling into first place. Or Josh Allen is going snowboarding on an inner tube and just being like, oh my God, here I am, first place in the MVP. Oh my gosh. Or when he's playing cards and he's basically like, wait, so if I win, I get more money? Like, it's just, it plays into the perfect Josh Allen narrative that he's just kind of like the dumb guy who just miraculously lucks his way into success. And that's just the narrative Josh Allen has played into. But you know what's going to play into that narrative even more? Being a damn anti-vaxxer at this time in America. And for my personal side of things, I just kind of got to talk about this real quick. We don't make other vaccines optional. If scientists are saying that it's 95 to 99% effective, and now we have a large enough sample size, i.e. hundreds of millions of people across the globe, and it's 95 to 99% effective, at a certain point, we got to just force some people to get a vaccine. We don't make chickenpox optional. We don't make tetanus optional. We don't make any of these vaccines that we give kids as children optional. You give the kids the damn vaccines, and you're an adult. You should be forced to take a vaccine. It should be mandatory to take a vaccine once the supply is available. I can't get a vaccine yet because I'm in my teens/20s, so I'm obviously not able to get a vaccine, but I am of an opinion we don't make any other vaccines optional, and I'm pretty sure that we should not be making this one optional. Why? Because dumb people like Josh Allen are going to tell on themselves that they are anti-vaxxers and don't necessarily believe in science, or the alternative measure, you've fallen down some ridiculous rabbit holes on the internet that have convinced you otherwise, because the internet can be a breeding ground for anything. If you watch the QAnon documentary on HBO, like, it is just a breathing ground for dumb people. That's kind of just the idea that is being portrayed there, is that the country was almost derailed and QAnon was started by some 16-year-old with a sex doll. Like, it is crazy how the internet can – it's a perfect – the QAnon's the perfect example for what the internet can produce and how people – will literally believe anything that provides them an answer to their question. And it's absolutely crazy that we are not forcing people to get vaccines once the supply is available. It just seems ridiculous to me that we don't make other vaccines optional, therefore we need to make all the damn vaccines permanent. So that's my 2 cents or 2 minutes on that idea. But Josh Allen, you're dumb. And you're playing into the dumb narrative that Josh Allen is a dummy who lucks his way into magical success and is the guy who, you know, rolls to his right and fires a ball 50 yards across his chest and has dumb tweets and dumb tweets, plays into his dumb football narrative. Not that he's stupid. Again, don't conflate dumb and stupid here. Dumb, like he does silly, dumb stuff that makes us scratch our heads like, come on, bruh, come on. Like his Jameis Winston being the crab leg guy, but also sometimes like Jameis Winston groping an Uber driver or Josh Allen's anti-Semitic tweets that are not as good as the funny tweets from Josh Allen's childhood that got dug up. Not quite as bad as that one. The anti-Semitic stuff is the problem. But then he does, not dumb on a different level. Josh Allen does dumb stuff, and we can laugh at it. Like being an anti-vaxxer, it's very silly. What do we want to go to here for the rest of the show? Ooh, the Mets are charging a comeback here. Well done, Mets. I guess we'll keep this one on right now. And Pete Alonso's doing awesome this year. I know that the season kind of just started, but it's been a nice little start to the season for them. New York Mets. Oh, yeah, I forgot Anthony Bass is still a Miami Marlin. That's kind of interesting. That's kind of just an obscure thing, but Anthony Bass used to be a pitcher for the San Diego Padres. He was like a sixth-inning guy years and years ago. Worked his way up to now being the closer of the Miami Marlins, who is about to blow a lead against the Mets as this one is scorched down the line by Brandon Nimmo. Going into third base is, I don't know who that is, but it is now third and second for the New York Mets here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. Couldn't really see who that was, but now coming up to the plate is probably going to be intentionally walked, but Francisco Lindor, as Brandon Nimmo slices one down the left field line, give the Mets a double and put the winning run just 90 feet away. Found that really interesting, is that, whoop, down the line. I have no idea who that is for the Mets. No idea who that guy is running from first base, but so be it. I'm guessing it's probably a pinch runner. Are they going to, yes, intentionally walk Lindor? Getting hyped. Lindor is hyping up this squad. That was the interesting thing about Francisco Lindor, because Francisco Lindor is probably the best shortstop in baseball right now. Like, the closest guys up there with him would be, like, Carlos Correa, maybe Corey Seager, but probably not Corey Seager. He was doing poorly before the World Series run last year. And Javi Baez is right up there. Yeah, but Fernando Tatis, of course, but again, Fernando Tatis is now hurt, but he's also only played less than 162 games in his career, so there's going to be a little bit of a trial period to figure out exactly what Fernando Tatis Jr. is, which obviously doesn't help because he's injured now, which, whew, was that an exhale for me to see that Fernando Tatis Jr. is going to be all right. Jonathan Villar is a Met, damn. Mets got everybody on this team. Now, I don't think it's going to actually help them be super good, but damn, the Mets got some good pieces on this team now. All they had to give up was Ahmed Rosario and a top prospect. As strike one comes on in for Michael Conforto, who is still somehow a Met after all these years. What has been, like 5 years for Michael Conforto? Still ends up being a Met. The Mets got some I don't think it's good enough to actually do anything. Like, the Mets are probably like fourth wild card behind the Braves, but that's a pretty good team they got there. This is like that Rockies team from a few years ago where they almost won the NL West and then got bounced by the Cubs. And strike two comes in to Conforto. Just got to put the ball in play, and you're going to give yourself a chance here. Just don't strike out. You're going to get a chance to win the baseball game. But it reminds me of that Rockies team from a couple years ago that almost won the NL West, and then they had to play like a one-game wild card against the Cubs. like Tony Walters walked off, like some random dude deep on the bench is going to walk off for them. I think Orlando Arcia ended up being the hero for that Brewers team as Conforto fouls off the 0-2 pitch, stays alive there. I don't know. I guess that would be kind of close for if just the comparison of having Arenado and some pieces around there like Conforto and Pete Alonso would be like your Charlie Blackmans and your Trevor Stories. You have a David Dahl. Obviously, they've got a deeper pitching staff, but not as great of a bullpen. As long as they're still turning to Edwin Diaz, they've got a bit of a problem as Conforto, again, fouls off, still remains 0-2. Mets are in an interesting place indeed. And obviously, like I was talking about with Lindor, like we're pretty sure Lindor is like the best player in the best shortstop in baseball. And the Cleveland was not going to pay the $340 million for him because Cleveland was not going to be competitive anytime in the near future. And I don't know, like as much as Lindor is the best shortstop in baseball, it feels a little bit of an indictment of the shortstop position because you know, outfielders are definitely the best. You got some first basemen in there. Obviously, DHs like Stanton and Judge are going to be up there. As a ball one comes into Michael Conforto on the play. And you've got, like, obviously, Ronald Acuna, Freddie Freeman, the Dodgers, Mookie Betts, Mike Trout. You can go down the list further. I don't know how much I want to. But anyways, the point being, the shortstop position has some depth in the middle ground, but the like, elite players, like, are probably Tatis and Francisco Lindor, and they hit Michael Conforto. They hit Michael Conforto on the arm, and it's a walk-off hit by pitch for the New York Mets. They hit Michael Conforto on the arm, and it's a walk-off hit by pitch for the New York Mets. Michael Conforto does not deserve to be dunked. Actually, that was fitting. Michael Conforto getting dunked with a single bottle of water is the appropriate celebration for getting a walk-off hit by pitch. Don Mattingly's going to argue because what are they going to do? Eject you from a game that's already over? Let's watch this again. Oh, he leaned into that one. That ball was over the strike zone, and Michael Conforto leaned into a hit by pitch. Oh, my gosh. Are they going to really go review it? Are they going to review? I think they are going to review it. Unless it's non-reviewable. But I think hit by pitches are reviewable, but he leaned into that one. That should be an out for Michael Conforto. His arm was over the plate. That should be an out for Michael Conforto. And did it hit him? It did hit him. Looks like it got him right on the elbow pad, which is definitely the best place to get hit, but he definitely leaned into that one. That one has got to be called back, but maybe it won't. I don't know. Like I've always said with sporting events, like bad calls are kind of just part of the game at this point. It's just something that we kind of have that exists. And they're going to rule it game over. Game over. And the New York Mets have won the game. What a day at the ball yard, ladies and gentlemen. The New York Mets walk it off with a single bottle of water, dousing their man Michael Conforto, who, again, is somehow still a New York Met. After all these many years, they've decided to hang on to him. Forgot about Jeff McNeil, too. Jeff McNeil is like the classic hit 330 guy, but the problem is when Jeff McNeil's hitting like 280, then all of a sudden he's not bringing you as much to the table, and he ends up becoming like your eight hitter. So it should be interesting to see that play out. Let's see how it goes for Michael or Jeff McNeil and the rest of these guys down in New York coming up this year, and Steve Cohen and all that lovely jazz that we're going to get to see. Brewers Cardinals kicking off, Mariners and Twins getting underway. Baseball, ladies and gentlemen, baseball. All right, let's see if there's some interesting news going on today. I had a few things that I wanted to come in with, including that LSU story, but let's just see if there's anything. Oh yeah, I forgot about the story with Philip Adams, the former NFL player who's charged as part of the mass shooting today. That was one thing. That Draymond KD podcast. I'm interested to see what kind of the headlines were of that. Jerry Jones liking Kyle Pitts. That one's kind of funny too. I found that interesting. I guess we never really talked about that NFL draft story from, what would that be now? I guess a few weeks ago, but yeah, let's talk about that Eagles side here, because the Eagles are obviously not going to be good. I had said before that the thing I feel most confident in, the Eagles are going to finish fourth in the NFC East, and the rest of the division is kind of a toss-up, because the Eagles aren't actively trying to win at this point. And if anyone can, this is one of the other things I've said, if anyone can and should believe in a rebuild, it should be the Philadelphia Eagles, because it's that rebuild that helped them win a championship the first time around. Now, they have made a lot of errors over that drafting period, and a lot of teams make mistakes in the drafting process. So it's not like that's like the end-all, be-all for them, no question. But there's this interesting thing that exists with teams who are in the rebuilding phase, is that there are three key parts to any rebuild. And we can talk about this with the Orlando Magic, too. We'll get to that, I guess, at some point. We never got to our rebuilding the Orlando Magic series. But there's three key parts of rebuilding in football. It is about resetting the salary cap in order to have money to spend once your competitive window opens, which creates more flexibility. It's about amassing as many draft picks as possible, especially the high one, because you want to take as many hits at the board as possible to try and land young, talented players that will enter their prime at the same time. And C, figure out your quarterback position. Figure out how do you want to build the quarterback position out from here. How much do you want to spend on it? What player do you want? Are you shooting for the moon and hoping that you land on Mars? Or shooting for Mars and hope you land on the moon? I think that's the phrase. It's shooting for Mars and hoping you land on the moon. Are you trying to spend big to fill your options, to fill your quarterback option like the Vikings did with Kirk Cousins or the Niners did with Jimmy Garoppolo, or the Raiders did with Derek Carr, the Falcons with Matt Ryan? Like, are you in it to secure your future or secure your present down by throwing money at it? Just figure out what your quarterback position is and roll with whatever you believe it can and should be. So those are the three steps. And the Eagles have to work through a few of those. It's why they traded down from 6 to 12 once they realized that their guy, Zach Wilson, for whatever reason they loved Zach Wilson, wasn't going to be there at pick 3. It's why they moved down all the way to pick 12. And so Devonta Smith might be the guy there, might be a defensive player, but regardless of where they go, this is about amassing talent for the long run. And your hope is that you can get a great pick right here to build foundationally, because the Eagles foundation right now kind of just represents what? Like, Fletcher Cox is part of it, I guess. Brandon Graham might be part of it, but I'm not sure if he makes it through the whole rebuild. Obviously, Jalen Reagor is a guy you're counting on big time for. Sidney Jones. Like, there's not a whole lot there in the core of the Eagles. I guess you could throw Miles Sanders in there, but Miles Sanders is a free agent at the end of the season. And would you want to keep Miles Sanders around for the long run? That's a two-way question for sure. Would you want Miles Sanders to be your running back for the future if you had to pay him, you know, X amount of dollars, Melvin Gordon money? It's a good question. So I don't know what's part of the Eagles' core right now, but this 12 pick could be a nice to build off of. But what the bigger part of it was, who wants just a 12 pick when you can get another mid to late first round pick from the Dolphins next year? Because this is the Sam Hinkie ideology that I kind of subscribe to in armchair GMing. It's just get as many hits at the board as possible. If you can keep getting hits on the board, it'll give you a better chance, because nobody knows exactly what these prospects are going to become. If we knew, then we wouldn't have a draft scouting process or all of this analysis towards it, everyone would know the players to pick, and they would just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The draft process is a bit of a crapshoot, and a lot of it has to do with the way you develop talent. But sometimes players fall through the cracks. There's immensely talented players that go to bad teams all the time, less so at the quarterback position, but at other places, for sure, all the time. And so this is the interesting place that you kind of reside in if you're the Eagles, is you don't know who's going to be great. You don't know if players are going to be awesome. You can infer and you can believe, and sometimes you can see from numbers that this player is better than that player. And a lot of times you can see just from their physical build and skill set, like a Kyle Pitts, that, oh, this dude is going to be unbelievably amazing. The same reason people said, like, A.J. Green was going to be a surefire Hall of Famer when he got drafted by the Bengals. It's just, oh, we can see just how ridiculous this guy looks and how amazing he is going to play as. And A.J. Green will one day have his jersey retired in Cincinnati. I'm not sure if he gets to the Hall of Fame, but he's had a Hall of Fame-worthy career. And so this is the interesting part with the Eagles right now. Your core is almost non-existent. You're doing the long haul rebuild. This is year one of your rebuild. Last year was a complete catastrophe. You dumped Carson Wentz. You made the hard move of accepting the dead cap penalties and just moved on and started again. And so this is the interesting boat that you reside in right now, is just where are you headed in your franchise's direction? What's the game plan, Spence? And the game plan is just, how do we get as many possible hits on the board? Because that's the Sam Hinkie ideology. And they only got one for moving from 6 to 12. It's a pretty damn good one, but it is a nice pick. You get an extra first-round talent coming in can only help. And the fact that you might have 3 first-round picks next year helps even more. But the 3 first-round picks don't matter as long as you supplement them with successful draft picks in rounds 4 through 7 or 2 and 3 at the very minimum. Like, supplement those selections with what you're looking for at the top of the draft. The top of the draft just gives you the best chance of landing a hugely successful talent. The reason that a lot, and all of these guys are talented. We learned this when Gabe Vincent was dropping 30 points for the Miami Heat. All these guys are immensely talented. The reason that people bottom out in the league is, a lot of it has to do with opportunity. It's what is the opportunity you're walking into. One of the reasons that guys like Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman emerged in the Legion of Boom is because the Seahawks had the blankest slate imaginable when Pete Carroll and John Schneider took over. Phillip Lindsay, 1,000 yards as a rookie running back. Well, the Broncos running back room was desolate, and he got the opportunity. James Robinson last year for the Jaguars, third leading rusher in the NFL. Why? Desolate situation with no running backs in the room. Their best running back, Leonard Fournette, was cut right before the season began. And so that gave opportunity in the Leonard Fournette role for James Robinson. And James Robinson was the third leading rusher in the NFL last year. And James Robinson is a great pickup. Antonio Gibson, same way with Washington. Great pickup based on opportunity. And the opportunity that's presented is where you find diamonds in the rough, is you give those players time to develop and grow. And if they contribute to winning, like Richard Sherman, like Cam Chancellor, 5th and 6th round picks, then all of a sudden you've found some diamonds in the rough. And diamonds in the rough supplements your first round pick of an Earl Thomas, for example. Or, you know, undrafted guys like Michael Bennett help support your first round picks. Like Marshawn Lynch, trading a bunch of picks to get him from the Buffalo Bills. Like, supplementing these picks and players is a super effective strategy for building a championship football team, or at the very least, building a team that accumulates lots of value. And the team that wins the championship every year in every sport is the team that accumulates more value relative to finances in a salary cap sport. That's the other disclaimer. In a salary cap sport, the team that ends up with the most value relative to what the salary cap represents and what they're paying is the team that wins the championship. And this is the interesting thing about sports and sports fandoms is a lot of it is about this player is good, this player is bad. But in reality, a lot of it has to do with this player is valuable or this player is not valuable. It's why we have most valuable player awards. It's kind of the way that these things kind of shape out over time. And so with the Eagles, they're moving down so they can get as much capital as possible. And for those teams that are like below the Eagles, who are trying to like supplement their playoff runs with young talent, first, second, third round picks are huge for doing that. And the Saints, we talked about this on the radio or on the podcast with Walter Mitchell of Revenge of the Birds. Supplementing talent through the draft is hugely effective, and the Saints are huge this offseason in need, hugely in need of landing some players to supplement their losses to guys like Quan Alexander and Emmanuel Sanders departing and not having a ton of money to spend in free agency, more so doing the work to circumvent the salary cap and get under the $100 million luxury tax penalty that they were at prior to season's end. And one of the ways that you do that is with Alvin Kamara and having Alvin Kamara be one of the worst second contracts that any player has signed. Alvin Kamara needs to fire his agent for that contract that Alvin Kamara got. It was not well done in Alvin Kamara's negotiating process. But sometimes there's just mess ups back and forth and back and forth. And so sometimes when you're trying to reset the salary cap, supplementing young talent is hugely effective, and that will be the case for the New Orleans Saints going forward, the Baltimore Ravens as Lamar Jackson gets a contract. That anti-vaxxer Josh Allen is going to be right up there. It's going to be interesting to see how a lot of these things play out when you supplement young talent and how you can keep the sustainability rolling and whether or not you can get more draft picks while also keeping your future selves in positions of success. All right, let's talk about the Orlando Magic, because we talked about this on deadline day. Is just if you're going to do a teardown, that is exactly how you do it. Is Orlando trading all of their players in like 36 minutes? That's the way you do a teardown if you're going to do a teardown the way that if you're going to do a teardown, do it the way that Baltimore did their teardown. And so, I'm sorry, not Baltimore, Orlando did their teardown. And Orlando is now going to stink. And that's kind of what they're rooting for, is same idea, get as many cracks at the board, as many cracks at the board as you can possibly get. We talked about this before, is like they walked away from the core of their team with three first-round picks. So wait, they walked away with the core of their team with three first-round picks, two second-round picks, Wendell Carter Jr., and I guess a little bit of cap flexibility, but R.J. Hampton. So they walked away with R.J. Hampton, Wendell Carter Jr., three first-round picks, and two second-round picks. That's what the Orlando Magic walked away with the core of their team, but the core, the big part of the rebuild and the way Orlando is going to get back to an even more competitive state than they were at before, how do you land superstars? Because Orlando got one. Well, they technically got two. But, you know, post-2000, post-Tracy McGrady, they technically got three now that I think about it. They got Shaquille O'Neal, they got Tracy McGrady, and they got Dwight Howard. And Orlando is still riding the waves of Dwight Howard, if you haven't realized that. Orlando got lucky enough 17 years ago to land the number one pick and land a generational talent in Dwight Howard, and they've been riding that wave ever. Orlando has gotten Dwight Howard, and they built a championship team around him and Jameer Nelson as the second best player. A team that went to a championship and almost went to a second one. And then when Dwight Howard was ready to leave, they flipped Dwight Howard for Nikola Vukovic. And Nikola Vukovic, for 7 years, was the core of the Orlando Magic roster. And Nikola Vukovic, with time, ended up becoming the player who, for better or for worse, Nikola Vukovic was an empty stat guy who helped, by making a couple of All-Star teams, be the centerpiece of a team that was 7th or 8th in the Eastern Conference. with Evan Fournier and DJ Augustine and some young players that never really got the chance to develop because they were kind of in that 7 to 8 range of draft pick where not good enough to start immediately and get kind of lost in the shuffle a bit. Mo Bamba, Jonathan Isaac, et cetera, et cetera. And a GM who subscribes to the best available player theory of drafting where you already had Vucevic and you drafted Mo Bamba and he just got kind of lost in the shuffle. And then you needed guard play and you drafted Jonathan Isaac because he was the best player available at that point. And so it's this interesting thing where Orlando tore it down immediately and now they can craft the roster in whatever image or likeness that they want it to be. Because the Orlando Magic, who lost to the Wizards, just imagine giving up 131 points to the Wizards. Like, that's just a tough sledding for y'all. Russell Westbrook had 23, 15, and 14. Like, Russell Westbrook is crazy. But anyways, so you've got Mo Bamba scoring 19 points coming off the bench. Another team that, you know, Terrence Ross coming off the bench, but your main guys in the starting lineup, Michael Carter-Williams, Dwayne Bacon, Chuma Okeke, who's obviously a first-round pick. He's like a fifth starter at this point. James Ennis, Wendell Carter, of course, and you're waiting to see if Jonathan Isaac has anything left after he comes back from his catastrophic injury. But you're kind of just in this interesting place where you're just – you don't care about this season. You've got some hopes for the future, and Mo Bamba, who now kind of just is the Jahlil Okafor equivalent now. He went from scoring 6 a game to 5.4 to 6 a game, so he's just going to have an NBA career of scoring 6 a game and having one career start. Wow. He's had one career start with the Orlando Magic, and I have a feeling Mo Bamba is going to be headed out the door real quick, you know, 4 and out in Orlando. But Orlando is just one of those teams where they're just kind of hanging on to guys because they can hang on to them at this point. Mario Hezonja is another example of that guy who just was one of those Orlando middle-of-the-pack draft picks that just never got the chance to actually play. So Orlando's sacrificing short-term success for those lottery picks. And by the way, giving up 131 to the Wizards is effective because you're fighting against the Wizards. And again, when we say this, all you're really fighting for is odds. You're fighting for odds and draft picks. That's what you're shooting for when you're talking about the Orlando Magic tank. And so you want a Cade Cunningham. You want a Jalen Suggs. You want an Evan Mobley. You want a Jalen Green. Those are the guys you're shooting for at the top of the draft. Just getting one of them to start building up that core the way you drafted Aaron Gordon, the way you drafted Jonathan Isaac, where you hoped he would be something bigger than what he was, but you still drafted him. The way you gave up a picks and a player for Markelle Fultz. Like, you're just drafting young guys that will build out the core of a team once they're ready to be competitive. And this is better than being, I argue, better than being a middle-of-the-pack team, or, in the case of Orlando, being 12 and having all your players versus being 14 in the East and not having all your players, but also turning Nikola Vukovic, Evan Fournier, and Aaron Gordon into RJ Hampton, Wendell Carter, 3 first-round picks and 2 second-round picks. Because that is a nice haul, given what you had, which was at the time a team that won 2 playoff games in 2 years and was a 7th seed 1 year and an 8th seed another year. You turned in a nice little haul for that team. And RJ Hampton scored, giving you 14 a night and trying to establish himself as maybe your point guard of the future. And Cole Anthony is another guy who's a point guard from this year's class, so you're just waiting to see if any of them will work out. Why not? That's kind of the thing I'm looking at. It's just, why not go for it? Might as well at this point. If Mo Bamba is on his way out and Terrence Ross is going to get traded at some point and you've got just Wendell Carter, if Terrence Ross is your best player at this point, he's coming off the bench, like, you might as well at this point. You might as well just get as low as possible and hope that a transcendent talent can come in and that hopefully maybe you kept the trend going where you've Nikola Vukovic, which is still the remnants of a Dwight Howard trade, into your next great generational superstar, not by a trade, but just by a byproduct of being able to tank to the top and maybe, just maybe, win some lottery odds and get a 14% chance at Cade Cunningham and a 42% chance at either Cade Cunningham, Evan Mobley, or Jalen Suggs. One last tour around the old diamond real quick before we sign off for the week. Looks like the Cubs are going to beat up on the measly Pirates. Let's laugh at the Pirates real quick. Let's see the Pirates roster. So you've got Adam Frazier, Kevin Newman. Oh, Kevin Newman, that's not awful. Brian Reynolds, Colin Moran, huge Colin Moran fan, 1-for-4 day today. Philip Evans, Gregory Polanco, who's just kind of just stuck at this point. Just stuck in the mud if you're Gregory Polanco. Jacob Stallings as your catcher. Dustin Fowler and Tyler Anderson as your opening day starter. Now, if those names don't resonate to you because you're not a huge baseball fan, don't worry. They don't really resonate to me either. Other than like Gregory Polanco and Colin Moran, who Colin Moran was the centerpiece of the Gerrit Cole trade. But hey, he's the four hitter on a poor Pirates team. So I guess, you know, things might work out in the end for the Pirates on that trade. It could have been a lot worse. At least you've got a building block through a terrible rebuild that hopefully Colin Moran can do something for you other than what Colin Moran usually does for you, which at this point looks to be about a 237 hitter. Yeah, hitting, what is he hitting this year? He's got a nice OPS so far, but having an OPS just under 800, slugging less than 420, except for last year where he hit 472. So he turned a corner, Colin Moran is stepping up, OPS plus of 112. You know what? Colin Moran might be their all-star next year. So who knows? This could work out really well for them. On-base percentage of 325. Yeah, Colin Moran, this could work out very swimmingly for you and your Pittsburgh Pirates family. Had 10 homers in 52 games last year. Yeah, Colin Moran, let's go. I am on the Colin Moran hype train, and I have been on the Colin Moran hype train for about 2 years now. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping into the Take It Easy radio show. We release episodes twice a week here. Wednesday's episode, we talked about college basketball and the changing landscape there. And today, of course, we went deep into all of these fun anti-vaxxer and baseball and rebuilding football and baseball football and basketball team stories. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, and non-binary people alike, take it easy. And we will talk to you again next week, exclusively on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash.